have a secret.
Uh-huh.
I use Secret Whole Body Deodorant because more than just my armpits stink.
Oh, can I use it where my bra rubs under my...
Oh, yeah.
And what about down there? You know, my...
Totally. 4 out of 5 gynecologists would recommend it. So I tried it, and now I get 72 hours of freshness from my pits to my...
Ooh, I love that it's a spray.
Me too. And it comes in sticks and creams, too. Go get your Secret Whole Body Deodorant.
With Spring Black Friday savings at the Home Depot, you can get up to $2,300 off select kitchen packages from top brands like GE Profile. That means you can save on a new GE Profile smart quad door refrigerator that's full of convenient features like a dual dispense auto fill pitcher and an ice dispenser with up to 12.5 pounds capacity. Bring convenience to your kitchen with smart, innovative appliances from GE Profile. Right now, save up to $2,300 on select kitchen packages with Spring Black Friday savings at the Home Depot. How doers get more done.
This is your typical radio ad while eating a Crunch Bar.
This is Automatic of Otto's Used Cars. This weekend only, we're having a whale. Bring the kids. See for yourself. It is huge. Gonna make a big splash. No other dealer can say they have a whale like this.
When things sound dull, turn up the fun with Crunch.
Looking to refresh your closet, home, or beauty routine this spring? Walmart's got all the stylish goods in one stop. From chic new looks and the latest makeup to quality furniture and tableware. Go to walmart.com/nowtrending. That's walmart.com/nowtrending for the hottest fashion, home, and beauty finds. Your style at Walmart.
What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Now look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Adam Kempinar.
And I'm Josh Larson.
New assignment. Since you two cowboys love to drink booze and smoke weed with kids, I'm going to send you to a place where that stuff is allowed.
Ooh, I love Disneyland.
You two sons of bitches are going to college.
Yes. No.
Ice Cube, Don't Lie, 21 Jump Street's Channing Tatum and Jonah Hill do graduate onto college this year, returning to movie screens along with a slew of sequels and familiar characters. This week's Film Spotting Top 5 has us looking forward to not sequels so much, but 2014's most anticipated performances.
I'm assuming Jonah Hill, not Tatum, is going to be on your list, Adam, given your Wolf of Wall Street love.
I don't know. Tatum's my boy.
We've also got a review of The Broken Circle Breakdown, the Oscar-nominated film from Belgium. All that and more.
Chemistry's the one with shapes and stuff, right?
Ahead on Film Spotting.
This episode is brought to you by Film Spotting listeners, including
platinum-level donor Gabriel Rivera from San Juan, Puerto Rico, and new $5 a month subscribers Dawn from Martinez, California, Luke from Northcote, Victoria, Australia, and Simon from Sully, the Vale of Glamorgan, United Kingdom.
We had to read Simon's just so one of us could say the Vale of Glamorgan, which is an exceptionally rich agricultural area that lies in the southern part of South Wales.
Also something in J.R.R. Tolkien's books, right?
I was going to say, forget the horrible title There and Back Again. That's what The Hobbit 3 should be, the Vale of Glamorgan. Tell me that doesn't sound like
would
an
you go see it, then?
I would go see that film in a heartbeat. We also want to thank Silver Club donors Eric in Durham, North Carolina, Kathy in Tempe, Arizona, and Eve in Denver, who sends this note for Dan Vaccaro, who has been a faithful listener since the beginning, from his loving wife.
Later in the show, we'll highlight some more donors and their feedback. Our thanks to everyone who sent some of their hard-earned dollars our way in support of the show.
You're listening to Film Spotting. Ah, Belgium. We have long loved you for your beer. We had no idea you were so into tattoos and bluegrass music. Or so we learned from watching The Broken Circle Breakdown, which recently earned an Oscar nomination for Best Foreign Language Film. Our review is later in the show.
But first, let's jump right into our list of 2014's most anticipated performances. With Michael Fassbender in only 4 movies this year, Adam, that still leaves a slot for The Batch.
Man, you are spoiling my top 5. You
just
completely ruined it here, Josh. But we are going to get to our top 5 most anticipated performances, basically part 2 2 of our 2014 preview, as last week here on the show, we shared our top 5 most anticipated movies, and we've already received some good feedback from listeners. We're probably going to get to that in future episodes, maybe in some bonus content, but I did think we should start as a little bit of a teaser and as a little bit of a looking back to that list. Let's get to some feedback from Peter Fulton in Brooklyn.
Hey guys, a couple of music-themed films I'm greatly looking forward to in the new year. The first one is Can a Song Save Your Life? This is writer-director John Carney's follow-up to Once, and I read some soaring reviews when it debuted at the most recent Toronto International Film Festival. Stars Mark Ruffalo, Keira Knightley, Hailee Steinfeld, and Catherine Keener. This is not an actual sequel to Once, but is said to be very similar in spirit and quality. Since Once is firmly cemented in my personal all-time top 10 list, a poster with a quote of praise from one Michael Phillips hangs over my sofa, my expectations could not be higher for this film. The Weinstein Company is supposed to release it sometime this year.
Yeah, that was completely off my radar. And
I had not heard about that either.
Based on my love for Once, I'm with you. Certainly there, Peter, that's one that I would have had to consider for my top 5. He also mentions Into the Woods, which was not off my radar. It just didn't make my list. He says, though director Rob Marshall has had a very spotty track record since Chicago, this Sondheim musical is an absolute favorite of mine, and I think it could work very well on film. The cast includes Meryl Streep, Emily Blunt, James Corden, Anna Kendrick, and Chris Pine in lead roles, and Johnny Depp as a wolf. A small role, thankfully. It's set for a Christmas release from Disney. So a festival movie there in the follow-up to Once, and Into the Woods going to be a bigger production coming around Christmas time.
That does sound intriguing. I just hope the wolf doesn't have a lot of headgear or crazy hats. That might be a better way to go.
It is
Johnny Depp.
You never know. But speaking of festivals, Sundance did just wrap up. And the movie that a lot of people were talking about, I saw Twitter just go crazy for this film that ended up winning 2 awards, the Grand Jury and the Audience Award winner, was a movie called Whiplash. And this will help us transition, Josh, into our most anticipated performances, because it's a movie from director Damien Chazelle. He made Guy and Madeline on a Park Bench, which is a movie I did see the year it came out, a couple of years ago, and enjoyed it. Certainly saw the marks in it of someone I wanted to see more films from. I think Michael Phillips had it in his top 10.
That's what I was going to say. I remember him talking about it quite a bit.
Yeah, so this movie, Whiplash, it stars our guy, Miles Teller.
Mm-hmm.
He plays a first-year jazz drummer at music school, and J.K. Simmons is his music teacher, his very intense music teacher, apparently. J.K. Simmons, one of those guys that's always fun to watch on screen. And Miles Teller, obviously, as we've talked about over this past year in particular with his performance in The Spectacular Now, one of those young actors we're both really encouraged by and want to see more of his work. So you add in the music angle there, you add in Damien Chazelle, and really all the love it was getting. It's one of those movies, you know, Sundance winners don't necessarily amount to a whole lot once that festival's over. It's not always a case where those movies are universally loved or necessarily do well at the box office, but everybody I follow on Twitter was in line with this pick here.
Yeah, and Teller was on my list of 2013 discoveries. So he's, I'll just say it now before we get to honorable mentions, he was definitely an honorable mention for my list for this role.
We are in agreement there. Let's see if we have any other picks that line up as we do actually get to our top 5 most anticipated performances.
I wanted to speak with you about your future. What do you hope to achieve, Mark?
I want to be the best in the world.
Well, even more Channing Tatum love as we play a clip from the trailer for Foxcatcher. Though Tatum isn't the reason why we're playing a clip from Foxcatcher. Josh, you might recall that when we did this list last January, my number one pick, the most anticipated performance for me, was seeing Steve Carell this movie, Foxcatcher. He plays a character named John DuPont, who is a wealthy supporter, fanatic of U.S. wrestling, and Tatum plays an Olympic wrestler named Mark Schultz. His brother is Mark Ruffalo, also an Olympic wrestler, and the DuPont character, this is not a spoiler because it's right there in the plot description and based on a true story, is a man who had some schizophrenia issues and ended up killing one of those two wrestlers. So for me, it was all about seeing the surprise of Steve Carell, who now, if you watch the movie The Way, Way Back from earlier this year, he played a real jerk in that movie. And I don't think we often think of him as just a blatant bad guy. He's pretty bad in that movie. But here we're going to see some layers probably and some darkness that I don't know has normally come through with Steve Carell. So that was my most anticipated performance. It got pushed back. Bennett Miller, the director of Capote and Moneyball, another big reason why I want to see this film. It's now a 2014 release, so Carell would still be in my list, but I'm just going to go ahead and call this the Steve Carell and Foxcatcher Memorial List because
fair enough.
It's twice now.
Yeah.
So with that, Josh, who's your number 5?
My number five is a comedian, and she's sticking in comedy with this role at least, but I'm okay with that. It's Melissa McCarthy in Tammy. McCarthy is still waiting for her ideal comic vehicle, I feel. I know a lot of people really liked her in The Heat last year with Sandra Bullock, and it did come close to giving her what I think will let her be her crazy best. There was a lot of unhinged moments in it, but in a way, it still seemed to hold her back a little bit for me. Just there are some conventional aspects to the story, and she never got to let loose in the way you think of an early Adam Sandler or an early Will Ferrell picture, which I think she has that capability. And I think Tammy has the potential to give her that freedom, because there's not going to be anyone holding her back here. It's based on a screenplay she wrote with her husband, Ben Falcone. And you may remember him as the air marshal who McCarthy's character has an encounter with in Bridesmaids. Now, this is interesting, too. Falcone also directs this film. So this is their own project. They're going to be able to do what they want. The story involves McCarthy's character who loses her job. She learns her husband has been unfaithful, and she hits the road to get away from all that. And she does this with her grandmother, who's played by Susan Sarandon.
Really?
So that should be interesting as well. Tammy opens on July 2.
Well, I don't have a release date for my number five, but I am going to stick with comedy. And this is a movie and a director first that got mentioned just at the tail end of our show last week when I was highlighting all the prominent filmmakers who have movies coming out this year. And I think this guy qualifies as prominent, even if I'm not such a big fan of his work. The director is Alejandro González Iñárritu. The movie is Birdman, and the star, who I can't wait to see, is Michael Keaton.
That's right. Yeah.
So you've got, first of all, Iñárritu, the guy who made 21 Grams and Amores Perros and Babel, these movies that are just super depressing and bleak for the most part. Also beautiful, the most depressing and bleak of the bunch. Also my least favorite of the bunch, I should add. And here he is making what's ostensibly a comedy. It's about an actor who was formerly a big star, apparently the star of something like Batman. So there's some crossover to real life here. He was very well known for this iconic comic book movie role, and now he's kind of washed up, and he tries to revive his career by doing a play on Broadway. Emma Stone's also in it, plays Michael Keaton's daughter, Zach Galifianakis, Ed Norton in it as well. So a great supporting cast there, and I'm curious to see what Iñárritu will do with comedy, because I truly believe the man has no sense of humor whatsoever. But it's really all about Michael Keaton, who is one of those actors that I'll just say I grew up with. You know, I loved watching Michael Keaton in everything, whether it was even trifle movies like Gung Ho or Mr. Mom. And then, of course, later Batman. He was just an actor who I always found so enigmatic and so charismatic. There always was just that little hint of darkness to him, something going on behind that mug that he was usually mugging for the camera a little bit. He was always very clever and very witty, and he was just always one of my favorite actors to watch in movies growing up and through junior high. So I've long been a fan of his work, and he has sort of fallen off the radar. He was in The Other Guys, the comedy.
He was great in The Other Guys,
which I never did actually see, so
really
I can't
funny.
Speak to whether he's very good in that role or not. But otherwise, the only thing I've seen him in recently was a movie I believe was shot here in Chicago called The Merry Gentleman that played at Sundance 4 or 5 years ago. I saw it at Sundance, and he plays a hitman in it. And he's one of those guys who's very sullen and withdrawn and introverted and, of course, can't really open himself up to anybody, and he doesn't say a whole lot. And he was really good. I mean, he's still Michael Keaton, despite the fact that he had to tamp down all of that oozing charisma. He was still so much fun to see on screen, and I want to see him on screen again in Birdman.
He's such a loose cannon. So
yeah,
no matter what he's doing, drama, comedy, you're never going to know what to expect. That's a really good pick. My number four is someone we've talked about a little bit. We've actually seen, because at the live wrap party, we showed the trailer for the Grand Budapest Hotel, which appears to be anchored by Ralph Fiennes. Michael Phillips at the show talked about how certain actors, only certain actors, are able to hit the particular beats of a Wes Anderson script. And I think the trailer showed that Fiennes can do that, at least. He seemed to fit right in there with the pattern, what you look for in a good Anderson actor. He has the lead role of Gustav H., who's apparently this legendary concierge. I didn't know that concierges could be legendary, but apparently that's the case.
In Wes Anderson's world,
probably.
It can be.
We often talk about, you touched on this a little bit with Steve Carell, about comic actors going dramatic and the inherent interest there is in seeing that. How about dramatic actors going comic? I think sometimes that's just as fascinating to watch how they're going to adapt their particular skills. I think in terms of Anderson, about Adrian Brody doing this in the Darjeeling Limited, didn't do much comedy beforehand, but I thought fit in really well playing Anderson's particular brand of comedy. So I'm excited to see Fiennes getting the chance to do that here. I guess his Hades in Clash of the Titans could be considered comedy, but probably a sure. little different vein of comedy than this.
Have you ever been questioned by the authorities?
Yes, on one occasion.
What?
I was arrested and tortured by the rebel militia after the desert uprising.
Right. Well, you know the drill then. Zip it.
Of course.
You never heard the word Van Hoytel in your life.
Got it.
Okay, let's go.
The Grand Budapest Hotel. I'm counting down the days. March 7.
One that will certainly get a discussion here on the show. And I agree with everything you said about Ralph Fiennes. Obviously a really talented actor, and seeing what he'll do with comedy. He's been, of course, in a few other comedies before. I'm thinking at least of Martin McDonagh's In Bruges.
In Bruges, yeah.
Which
yep.
he has a pretty blatantly comedic
steals those
character
scenes.
There. And he does. He steals those scenes. So he's one of those guys who can do just about anything. Great pick. My number four, well, it's a little bit of a cheat, but Josh, as we're going to hear, I know later in the show, you had an entire ensemble last year
yes.
on your list. So you've got
I may
no,
be cheating again this
yeah,
year.
Yeah, you've
this
got
is
no
the
room
only
to
list
talk.
I cheat on.
It's true. So I'm going to take advantage of that and cheat myself. I've got a double pairing here, two stars, two actresses being paired against each other in this movie. And one of them was my number four from last year, Rooney Mara, in the Steven Soderbergh film Side Effects. She did not disappoint. Obviously, I was a huge fan of her performance and that film overall. She's going to star alongside Cate Blanchett in Todd Haynes' Carol, another one that, sadly, I don't have a release date for. Hopefully, it will come out in 2014. Right now, it's still in pre-production, so who knows, but most people are considering it a 2014 release, and it's based on a Patricia Highsmith novel called The Price of Salt that, at least according to the description in front of me, is called a landmark lesbian novella. So I haven't read it, not familiar with it, but that is the mantle that this story carries, and Cate Blanchett plays the main character, the title character, Carol, who basically develops this relationship with a younger woman, a girl in her 20s, who's working in a department store and has grandiose dreams of doing something better. And Blanchett plays a character who has money and seems to have a fulfilled life. Kind of reading the description, it makes me think a little bit of her character in Blue Jasmine, pre-nervous breakdown, basically. And as she is having this discovery about herself with this character, she's sort of trying to hang on to everything else in her life. So seeing for me two of the most alluring screen actresses we have right now, different generations, obviously, but seeing Blanchett and Mara opposite each other is the big draw for me for this film, in addition to Haynes, who I do enjoy his work. But both actresses, I think, are exceptionally good at playing characters who are sort of hiding inner desires. And there's something that's just bubbling underneath the surface that they're often withholding. And that makes them very often exciting characters to watch on screen. And at least based on the short description there that I gave, it sounds like this is going to be right in their wheelhouse, which isn't really what I go for with this type of list, Josh. I do like to pick the Steve Carell's, sort of the surprises. I want to see new depths to a character. Really, for me, it's about seeing not so much these characters hit familiar notes, but seeing them play off each other, seeing Mara and Blanchett play off each other.
And I think Haynes is one of those directors we could have included on that big director list we
Without
talked about last show.
Yeah, I did list him.
Okay, good, good. It's been a while. I mean, we had I'm Not There in 2007 and then the Mildred Pierce
mm-hmm.
TV
HBO
version,
series, yeah.
which I actually didn't see, unfortunately. But
and I'm a huge fan. Not only, as I said, I liked Todd Haynes, but I love the original Mildred Pierce movie.
Yes, great film.
One I still need to catch up with among so many other TV series I need to see, unfortunately, Josh.
Well, I believe it's going to be an accent first in Massacre Theater next, followed by our review of The Broken Circle Breakdown. And in light of the Sundance premiere of Life Itself, the documentary adaptation of Roger Ebert's memoir, the film spotting poll touches on a few of the late great critics' favorite films. Stay with us.
I'm so tired of being alone. It's been a 10 while, so all I've known.
Hi there, Film Spotting Original Recipe listeners. Allison Wilmore here from Film Spotting Streaming Video Units. And on the latest episode of our podcast, Matt Singer and I look at The Hunt, one of the contenders for the Best Foreign Language Film Oscar.
The Hunt is the story of a man who's falsely accused of a terrible crime, and we'll be looking at other films about people accused of acts they didn't commit, all available to rent or stream. To listen or subscribe to the show, you can find us in iTunes or at filmspottingsvu.com.
We all are born with a certain package. We are who we are. Where we were born, who we were born as, how we were raised. We're kind of stuck inside that person. And the purpose of civilization and growth is to be able to reach out and empathize a little bit with other people. And for me, the movies are like a machine that generates empathy. It lets you understand a little bit more about different hopes, aspirations, dreams, and fears. It helps us to identify with the people who are sharing this journey with us.
Welcome back to Film Spotting with Josh Larson. I'm Adam Kempinar. That was Roger Ebert in a clip from Life Itself, the new documentary about the late great film critic from director Steve James, Chicago's own Steve James, of course. We'll talk about the movie next week when Michael Phillips sits in for his monthly visit, and our poll question this week has us asking about some films that Ebert famously championed. I'm looking forward, Josh, to seeing the responses we get to that. Right now, though, it's time for Massacre Theater.
We perform a scene, you get a chance at winning a prize. Last time, Adam and I massacred this scene.
There were these women, you know, on the Sally Jesse Raphael show the other day. And they were all wearing disguises so that their husbands couldn't find them. And they were living in shelters. And I thought I could go and live in one of them. If they'd let me bring Walter with me,
no.
I could go and live in one of
no,
them.
No, listen to me
someplace
a minute.
Someplace in another state where no one even knows who I am.
Look, couldn't you just get a divorce? And then...
And then you would get the condo. And he'd get the car. And he'd take Walter from me. He'd take Walter.
Listen, I know you think I'm just a kid, but I could never do anything bad to you. Or ever hurt you. A guy that does that to someone like you doesn't deserve to live. That's the truth, he doesn't deserve to live.
That was Nicole Kidman as Suzanne Stone Moretto and Joaquin Phoenix as Jimmy Emmett in To Die For from 1995. It was written by Buck Henry and directed by Gus Van Sant.
Yes.
And I can say, having tried to be Nicole Kidman very poorly, I was disappointed in that, by
great.
The way. They must keep an oxygen tank on her sets all the time because she's got to run out of breath pretty quickly talking that way.
Yeah, especially it was very, very hushed. Very breathy, had that whisper to it.
She does a lot of variations on that in almost all of her films, though.
Well, I thought you did a great job, Josh, as did our listeners. And we had many listeners who noted many tie-ins to our show last week. Why would we pick a scene from To Die For? Well, Anthony Libercioli in A Story in New York says lots of tie-ins to our review of The Wolf of Wall Street, such as the theme of using deception to achieve the up-by-your-bootstraps American dream. Both lead characters break the fourth wall and speak directly to the camera. Both leads rope others into a larger criminal conspiracy. Kidman and DiCaprio both won Golden Globes for their work, and both were based on books which were based on true stories. Were any of those on our minds, Josh, when we picked To Die For?
So.
Not a single one. Thank you, Anthony. Who also says, here's a question for self-reflection. After considering all of these similarities, why did I enjoy To Die For way more than The Wolf of Wall Street?
I could give him a lot of reasons, but we don't want to open that can of worms again.
No, we don't. Let's hear from Nathan in Atlanta.
One connection he had, it's a very dark comedy with a completely unredeemable but fascinating lead character.
Fascinating,
like
Josh.
The Wolf of Wall Street. His second connection was that last week's Massacre Theater had Risky Business starring Tom Cruise, who's separated from the former Mrs. Tom Cruise, Nicole Kidman.
I love that. I love that many people did notice that we had a scene starring Tom Cruise, and then the following Massacre Theater was Nicole Kidman. Again, not
unplanned.
By design. One that was planned. finally, Nathan hits on it with his number three. This was it. This is all we were going for.
In the overlooked for Oscars section, you mentioned Joaquin Phoenix, who had one of his first major roles in To Die For.
There you go.
That was all we needed. Number four, To Die For, American Hustle, and The Wolf of Wall Street are all about ambition, self-absorption, a willingness to use people to get what you want, and Nathan's last connection. These films feature great comedic performances from dramatic actors, Nicole Kidman, Leonardo DiCaprio, Jennifer Lawrence, and Christian Bale.
So it turns out there was one other small tie-in that our co-producer Sam Van Halgren was going for, and that is that Nicole Kidman, she has a big 2014 release as we were looking ahead to the most anticipated movies of the year. She's going to star in the Grace Kelly biopic from the director of La Vie en Rose. So the only problem with that connection, of course, Josh, is that that movie didn't make our top five. And Kidman, I don't think, is going to make our top five this week either.
She's not on my list.
No, she's not on my list. So that's where we were going with the tie-ins, but we really do love reading everything you guys come up with and appreciate all the entries we got. If you want to hear Josh's take on Kidman, plus our review slash shouting match of The Wolf of Wall Street and American Hustle, plus those top five most anticipated movies of 2014, you can find the show at filmspotting.net or get it via iTunes. Josh, reach in to the kind of brimming film spotting hat and pick out this week's winner.
The winner is Pat Galvin from Anchorage, Alaska.
Congratulations, Pat. Email feedback@filmspotting.net to claim your film spotting t-shirt. Josh, I put the order in this week. We got some new black ones, some new navy ones coming. Looking forward to
it. Do I get to pick my color?
You,
or did you not order one for me?
You will get a discount.
Thank you.
You will get a discounted one, but that's it.
Appreciate it.
Camera 見て、カメラ目線で、ゆっくりと。ね、パッションが、カメラ、目には。
My side.
パッションだよ。わかった?
And, with intensity.
Is that everything? I mean, it seemed like you said quite a bit more than that.
We move on now to this week's edition of Massacre Theater, and Josh, I don't know what we're going to say about this one, actually. I don't know what hints we can give away. It's kind of a vague scene, but really the only scene from this film that didn't completely give it away.
Yeah, this is going to be tough.
Yeah.
Maybe we'll insert a clue in with one of the names.
Yeah, we
help.
May have to change a character's name, and maybe it will help you out.
We should also consider there are some door effects here, a closing door effect.
Oh, yeah.
Do we want to work this in? Well, if I'm taking the part that we talked about, then I think maybe I'll draw that line out. You could get up while I'm talking, open the studio door, close it, and get back to the mic in time.
Oh, come on.
Should we try it?
No, that's like method acting. I don't want to do that. We got to come up with some good sound effects here. I'll just knock something over.
Okay.
We'll figure
that's
it out.
That's worked before.
It has, indeed. I don't know, though, that the name you've picked is going to help anybody at all.
It'll help, yeah.
You think so?
I do.
Okay. Well, Josh, with that, I'm going to start it off, so you're going to give me the action.
All right, here we go. And action.
Who is it?
Mikhail Baryshnikov.
Actually, I'm not really up yet.
May I come in? Please. Hi. You and I need to talk. I've got us some break. I'm sorry. I didn't realize you had some company.
Hey, who do you think you are?
I'm the guy you know better than my closest friends do. Why don't you put some clothes on? Get rid of your girlfriend. We need to talk.
And
scene.
I think you did that scene as Mikhail Baryshnikov.
Well, that was my intent.
Who has
so thank
nothing
you
to do with
thank
this movie
for,
whatsoever.
Thank you for picking up on that.
If you know what film we just massacred, and I don't know how you're going to decipher that, email the movie's
no
title.
Entries
literally,
for
this could be the lowest ever. Email the movie's title along with your name and location to feedback@filmspotting.net. Your deadline is Monday, February 3rd.
Oh boy. The winner will be selected randomly from all the correct entries and announced on next week's show. To get official Massacre Theater rules, visit filmspotting.net.
I figured it out. It's a Russian Inigo Montoya.
I think you're right.
In the beginning, the end. I am unique. From that precise moment when I was dragged out of my mother's womb into this cold world, I was complete. An amalgam of the DNA passed on to me by my mother and father. And they too had been born finished products, with their DNA handed down by their respective parents, and so back ad infinitum. It is clear to me that I was always there, somewhere in my ancestors' DNA, just waiting to be born. So this unique I has always existed, even in the mystery of nothingness. So where to start?
Just when you thought we had finally turned the corner on 2013 and we weren't going to talk about Sarah Polley's Stories We Tell anymore, we have to go back to that. Well, that was actually Michael Polley, Sarah's dad, there in the movie. And last week, in the wake of Oscar nominations, we asked you for our poll question about Oscar snubs. Stories We Tell managed to be, Josh, the rare film that had the pleasure of being snubbed by both the Academy and by us here on Film Spotting. We'll turn it back over to Anthony, who we heard from earlier from Astoria, New York.
What the heck is with a poll question about Oscar snubs that doesn't include Stories We Tell as a Best Doc nomination? Slacking, boys, that was a jaw-dropping snub.
Wow. So it does turn out that we excluded that. And I think that's one that I certainly saw on Twitter that day when the nominations were announced. There were a number of people like me who were very surprised that it didn't make the final cut. Then again, we shouldn't necessarily be surprised. That category has a rich history of some of the best documentaries of the year being overlooked. But it is true that Stories We Tell was left off completely. So we do want to apologize for that. We think it's one that probably belonged there, but there were a lot of performers and movies that were snubbed, and we only gave you six options. So the question was simple. If you had the power, which 2014 Oscar oversight would you correct? So here were your six choices. Tom Hanks for Best Actor in Captain Phillips, Inside Llewyn Davis for Best Picture, James Franco for Best Supporting Actor in Spring Breakers, James Gandolfini for Best Supporting Actor in Enough Said, Julia Louis-Dreyfus, Best Actress, Enough Said, or Oscar Isaac, Best Actor for Inside Llewyn Davis. Josh, how did it come out?
My choice is in last place. It's starting to be a familiar feeling, but Julia Louis-Dreyfus only received 7% of the vote. Her co-star, not that much more support. James Gandolfini received 9% of the vote. Oscar Isaac for Best Actor for Inside Llewyn Davis received 12%. Right along there with him, a couple other actors. James Franco for Best Supporting Actor for Spring Breakers, 15%, and 17% for Tom Hanks for Best Actor, but the clear winner, Inside Llewyn Davis for Best Picture, 41% of the vote.
I had faith in the Film Spotting audience that that would probably come through as the number one answer. I almost excluded it. I thought we should leave it out and see how all those actors really competed against each other. Might have been, in the end, a more interesting poll question, a more challenging one. But Inside Llewyn Davis, happy to see it there, getting some love from the Film Spotting audience. And we heard from Jonathan, who said this one really needs an all button.
Absolutely. I like that idea.
That would be our choice if we did include that. But Nathan M. says, if you can nominate The Wolf of Wall Street for Best Picture and still have a 10th slot left over, ouch, I think that's a slam. Is that a slam there, Josh, on The Wolf of Wall Street? Then you'd better put Inside Llewyn Davis in there. It's not only an oversight, but it's just plain inexcusable.
That is an awkward thing about this system they have where they don't have to fill the 10 slots.
Right.
Is it gives everyone who has another picture they're passionate about that opening to say, couldn't you have just given it that one?
Yeah, yeah, it's true. Joel Rackle, though, in Edmonton, Alberta, he's got the best take on it, I think.
I'm voting for Tom Hanks and Captain Phillips because even though Inside Llewyn Davis's snub is egregious, the Academy's rejection of Llewyn Davis is perfectly poetic. It's like Llewyn's life story lives on through the film itself. It's just another dismissal. The Academy is the new Bud Grossman.
I think we should say that. We're going to sit down to watch the Bud Grossman.
The Bud Grossman
instead
show.
Instead of the Oscars. It works for me. I think Joel nailed it. And Joel, I don't want to throw you under the bus, but since you kind of threw yourself under the bus, Joel is the listener from Edmonton there who we read an email from him. He chastised us for our Golden Brick candidates. He said, all these movies got so much attention already, or a lot of attention. They weren't obscure enough. And a couple listeners did catch that we read his email where he said that Stories We Tell was an Oscar nominee last year. Well, obviously it wasn't, and it didn't get one this year either. He caught it too and wrote in saying that he was sorry that we ended up reading that. I must have been thinking of some Canadian awards that won, as it got a 2012 release here in Canada and won some of our national awards. Not a big deal, but he did feel bad about that. So
at
thanks,
least
Joel.
We're consistent in our mistakes. They've all recently involved Stories We Tell.
That's
so.
True. That's true. Good. Sam in Martinez, California says, I was stuck between Franco for supporting actor and Inside Llewyn Davis for picture. I ended up going with the latter. I think Franco gave a career best performance in a movie that, aside from some truly great scenes, felt like wasted potential. But I think that Inside Llewyn Davis is definitely one of the best of the year, and it's absurd that it wasn't nominated. I can't figure it out.
It is puzzling. John in Bloomington, Indiana added Gandolfini in the place of Bradley Cooper. He wants to swap him out there. I'll take subtlety and quiet dignity over volume and abrasiveness any day, though the Academy's another story.
Man, he's so right on there. That one for me was a tough one because not only did I want to see Gandolfini for sure in that top five, but then to see Bradley Cooper in there as well. And I don't think he's a bad actor. I really
don't. We didn't get a chance to talk about that. He didn't work for you at all.
No,
American
he really
Hustle.
Didn't. And it's not just abrasiveness and volume. It's, of course, the perm as well. I mean, I don't know.
It's
an
strictly
easy shot,
it's
but
strictly the perm you object to.
No, no, it's actually it's
you know,
actually
I,
the
I thought he was okay there, but I sensed him straining in a way he didn't in Silver Linings Playbook with David O. Russell. So it's interesting that their follow up together to a degree, you could see him working harder instead of having the sort of looseness you think would come
with a second film with a director.
Yeah, he's one of those guys. That's how I've always seen him. I feel like he's always working very hard. And certainly I felt that way in American Hustle as well. Close it out with Josh in Farmington, Connecticut. He says, I'd like to suggest another option. Yes, of course, many people would, but we were trying to force you into that tough choice. He says, I'm surprised that Robert Redford didn't get a Best Actor nod for All Is Lost. Certainly Josh isn't alone there. It's a minimalistic performance in a minimalistic movie, but he's able to communicate far more without speaking than many actors can with dialogue. Redford resists pinning the character down or defining him beyond his basic human traits, and in doing so, he becomes a universal figure. It's a very big role that's written to be very small, and Redford's portrayal of it is one of the best performances of the year, bar none.
All Is Lost, you've seen. I never caught up with it. Would you agree that that should have been up there?
I think he was definitely in the top 10. I was whittling down my list of the best performances, that one stood out. And of course, it's a showy performance in that it's so remarkably unshowy. I mean, I think he nailed it there because of the fact that anytime you've got an actor who is really relying on no dialogue at all, it's all physical, and it really is so subtle, that is something that's going to stand out. And it could be done poorly. Redford is really good. He is certainly watchable in every single moment and believable in every single moment of that film. And when a guy can carry a 2-hour film or hour and 40 minute film without really letting you in via dialogue to his psyche at all, and yet you find yourself really caring about his plight, I suppose, that is something. There is an achievement there, and I do think that it's one of the better performances of the year, if not in my top five. So thanks to everyone who voted in that poll question. We hope you'll go to filmspotting.net and participate in this week's poll question, where we are thinking about Life Itself, the new documentary about Roger Ebert. We are going to spend a few minutes on that film next week as Michael Phillips from the Tribune will be joining us. We certainly look forward to getting his perspective. And we were kicking around a lot of different potential Roger Ebert questions here, and one that stood out because, selfishly, Josh, this is a topic that I had planned on teaching last summer at my University of Chicago Graham School class, a continuing education class that's open to anybody. I was going to have the topic all focused on Ebert, and the syllabus was going to be full of movies that Ebert championed, that really some of them were widely seen or became more acclaimed only because Ebert championed them. And that didn't happen last summer. I am hoping to teach it this summer. So a little bit of a tie-in here, as some of these films are certainly on the syllabus or in the running for the syllabus. There are five options here that are movies that Ebert was staunchly behind, and we want to know which of these you're most thankful Ebert championed.
Wide variety of films here, and we have some of Ebert's writing on each of them. Dark City from director Alex Proyas, a 1998 film Ebert wrote. Dark City is a great visionary achievement, a film so original and exciting, it stirred my imagination like Metropolis and 2001 A Space Odyssey. So high company there. He also championed Eve's Bayou from Cassie Lemons, 1997 film. Eve's Bayou resonates in the memory. It called me back for a second and third viewing. It is a reminder that sometimes films can venture into the realms of poetry and dreams. Then we have a couple documentary choices here. The first is Errol Morris's 1978 picture Gates of Heaven. I've seen this film perhaps 30 times, Ebert wrote, and am still not anywhere near the bottom of it. All I know is it's about a lot more than pet cemeteries. Another doc, Hoop Dreams from Steve James, 1994. A film like Hoop Dreams is what the movies are for. It takes us, shakes us, and makes us think in new ways about the world around us. It gives us the impression of having touched life itself. And then a final option for you here is Charlie Kaufman's 2008 film, Synecdoche, New York. The surface may daunt you, Ebert wrote. The depths enfold you. The whole reveals itself, and then you may return to it like a talisman. Wow, is that ever not a money review?
I love that. That's Ebert, his own commentary there on his own review. One of the great things about his writing oftentimes is how personal it was and how he would comment in that way on what he was saying and anticipating the reader reaction to it. So those are your choices. And Josh, this is a question, like a lot of our poll questions, where you can sort of interpret it different ways. When you're asking someone, which one are you most thankful Ebert champion? Maybe it's your favorite of the bunch and you're just grateful that he pushed it and more people may have seen it because of his criticism. Or maybe it's the one, and this is where I'm going with the question, it's the movie that you had the most personal connection with. Maybe it's because of Ebert's review that you saw this movie and enjoyed it. So how are you answering?
Wow. With all those choices, I guess my instinctual response is a combination of a lot of that. I probably would have heard of Hoop Dreams anyway, just being from the Chicago area and Steve James being a Chicago filmmaker. It would have gotten more attention here than anywhere else. But still, the level of notoriety that was brought to that really excellent documentary nationwide was all due to Ebert and all deserved. So that's my pick, Hoop Dreams.
Yeah, that's a great one, because there's no doubt that Siskel and Ebert putting that atop their top 10 films of that year, maybe not both of them number one, or maybe they did. I don't remember now, but they both had it very high, and they were huge champions of that film. And I remember that. I remember watching Siskel and Ebert in 1994 and saying, I have to go see Hoop Dreams, because I saw them talk about it. And yet I think the one I'm going with is actually the one that I would say is my least favorite of the bunch, and I really like the film. That's just how good these five movies are. I'm a big fan of Eve's Bayou, but it's one I certainly would not have sought out at all if Roger Ebert didn't name it his number one film of that year. It was his favorite film of 1997, and it's one I was living in Iowa at the time, wasn't going to come to a theater anywhere near where I was living, but he raved about that movie, and the way he talked about it was so interesting and so compelling that I said, as soon as I get a chance, I am going to see this film. And I remember as soon as it came out, going down to Blockbuster. Remember, Josh, when there were video stores?
I remember Blockbuster.
I went.
I
probably had to get it on VHS.
Yes.
That's how long ago this was, and watched Eve's Bayou. And it is a film that really did connect with me. So I think I'm going with Eve's Bayou, though. Again, I could really say all of them. Gates of Heaven might be the only one where I was familiar with Errol Morris before I discovered Ebert and the fact that he loved that film. But otherwise, the fact that Ebert had something profound to say about all these movies and really did push for them had a big impact on my enjoyment of them as well. So we think a lot of you have that experience with Ebert's reviews, and we're curious for your votes and your responses. You can vote now at filmspotting.net. A couple other brief notes we did want to fit in. We've talked about it a little bit, but starting soon, I think 2 weeks, we're going to finally kick off our first marathon of 2014.
That's right.
It is the work of Satyajit Ray.
Order the DVDs already.
Indian
Can't wait.
Filmmaker. Yes. And he is someone who is obviously acclaimed. Some of those films have been atop that Sight and Sound list or in the top 10. Certainly, I think there's seven of them in the top 250 of all time. We haven't quite decided if we're going to watch all the films in the Apu trilogy or not, but we've drilled down to the ones we're focusing on. We think anyway, 5 to 7 films, and we really want you to follow along. You can get that whole marathon lineup at filmspotting.net and clicking on the marathons link. Also on our website, if you click on apps, you can get all the information you need about how to get the Film Spotting app for iPhone, Android, or Windows 8 phone. Couple advantages to having the app. One is a lot of times the show is released early. If you're one of those people who can't wait to get it on, say, Thursday afternoon, the podcast goes up instead of Friday morning. And also you have access to the bonus content that we oftentimes offer you. And this week we're going to have a little bit of extra audio getting to your feedback on a top five from the Dallas Buyers Club. We shared our favorite actor transformations. We also got some great feedback, Josh, on listener discoveries of 2013 in response to our list. And there's a good email here as well I want to share from someone who was a little bit out of shape, Josh, that we didn't give any credit to the original Icelandic writer and director of the movie that inspired David Gordon Green's Prince Avalanche. So we'll share that email. And we have to credit as well a listener, Josh, named Simon David Knight. I forgot to mention this to you. I just rediscovered the package laying around my house. Went to the post office box around the holidays, found a package from Simon in Reykjavik. He mailed this package to us. He ordered for us that movie, Either Way, I believe it's called.
Oh, really?
The original Icelandic version of Prince Avalanche.
Very nice.
He wanted us to see it and sent it our way. You love getting packages from Reykjavik, from listeners all the way across the world in Iceland.
Doesn't happen all that often.
No, it doesn't, but it really was nice to see, and we thank you, Simon, for that.
If I needed you, would you come to me? Would you come to me for 2 weeks, my pain? And if you needed me, I would come to you. I would swim the seas for 2 weeks, your pain.
And the night falls.
the sweet, soulful voices there of Johann Heldenberg and Firla Bytens as Didier and Eliza singing Townes Van Zandt's If I Needed You from the film The Broken Circle Breakdown. And Josh, we're going to give everyone a little peek behind the curtain here. Without an obvious new release to focus on this week, we were considering four options. First, Life Itself, the Roger Ebert documentary, decided to push that off for a week to talk about it with Michael Phillips. We also thought about The Selfish Giant, the new film from the director of The Arbor, Cleo Barnard,
right?
That's a Golden Brick winner here on Film Spotting, and even though we did choose to go in a different direction, that's a movie we're both very excited to catch up with. It's available via iTunes, but it's not available theatrically like the other two movies we narrowed it down to. One of them was The Past, the latest from Asghar Farhadi. He made A Separation a few years ago. It was the 2012 Best Foreign Language Film Oscar winner, and also Fireworks Wednesday, a movie from 2008 that we talked about in our Contemporary Iranian Cinema Marathon. So it was a tough choice between The Past and The Broken Circle Breakdown, which we ultimately decided on because it did just open in select cities recently. It opened here at the Music Box in Chicago, but we really chose it mainly because of its cachet as a 2014 Best Foreign Language Film Oscar nominee. I was leaning towards The Past, but Josh, you and Sam pushed for Broken Circle. And the brief plot summary I saw somewhere didn't deter me. I knew it was set in Belgium, and that it was about a tattoo artist, Eliza, and a banjo player, Didier, who fall in love and also perform bluegrass music together, she performing with her voice, not with a needle and ink, just to clarify. With the word breakdown there in the title, I figured there was a good chance that this romance wasn't going to end blissfully. So I was prepared for some accusations and recriminations, angst and misery. What I wasn't prepared for was the particular angst and misery and despair and disillusionment that comes with a child suffering from cancer. And there's no spoilers here because the movie begins 7 years after Eliza and Didier meet with their six-year-old daughter, Maybelle, who's named after legendary country artist mother Maybelle Carter, getting her diagnosis and undergoing treatment.
I did not want to tell you that either because
you knew I would just say.
I saw it before you did and I thought, oh boy. Actually, I was worried he's going to watch this and say, we're not doing
right.
This movie. We have to change and go back to the past.
So here's what happens when you wait till literally the last possible minute.
That's
and watch
what I was
the
counting
movie
on
the night before, which I always end up doing. So I had nowhere to go. And hey, it's not as if a Farhadi film is probably going to be that much lighter.
That's true.
But you can certainly get lighter than Kids with Cancer, which is just about the worst thing if you're going to pitch a movie to me. So after we see that beginning and we meet those two characters and their daughter, the director, Felix van Groeningen, darts around in time. He flashes back and forth almost scene to scene, the structure connected not by chronology, but content and imagery. I watched this at home, as I said, just last night, watched it via screener. My wife, Sarah, was sitting next to me, but she never fully committed to the movie. She had her tablet out so she could take refuge in that if it got a little too heavy. And about halfway through realizing that she was a little lost, she asked me the question I'm going to pose to you now, and I'm going to see if you can offer a better answer than I did. She wondered, what's the point of jumbling up the story? And she meant really in movies in general, but obviously influenced by what she was seeing on screen, telling it out of order like Broken Circle Breakdown does. What's added with that technique, if anything? And it did make me think, would the film, this film, be as effective if it was just the story of this man and this woman and their daughter from the moment those characters met and fell in love all the way up to the end? And if so, does that make you appreciate the film more or less?
Well, the point is to winnow out those people who can't commit to the film and are on their tablets while they're watching. Shame on you, Sarah.
Exactly. Well, hey, she was never buying in from the moment it started. So
yeah, I think what that sort of structure can do in a good way is to let you live within the mind of its characters a bit more deeply if you're seeing this as their memory to one extent.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what the structure did for me with The Broken Circle Breakdown. I was sensing that they were reliving some of this, even as we're watching them live it at the same time. The weight of it can feel a little bit heavier. I also think, and this was a bit of a problem for me, it's a suspense trick. Because you can dole out little tidbits of information and you can give hints of what might come and it might be something really bad, but mm-hmm. we're not going to show you for sure, and then go back to the narrative proper and hold you in that suspense. And when it does involve something like a child with very serious, potentially terminal cancer. That's where this started to verge on being a little bit exploitative to me of that storyline. Ultimately, the movie saved itself from going too far in that direction, where I did end up appreciating the structure it used. And I think a lot of that has to do with the fearlessness that the two leads bring to those medical scenes. Heldenberg and Baytons together, they're both really strong in embracing the grief in a way that's authentic and not manipulative, not cloying at all. The medical scenes are pretty grim in a way that feels authentic and not manipulative. So I think that worked for it. But but there's a danger in that structure, too.
Yeah, I definitely didn't feel that it was exploitative. And maybe it's because there were so many other things that I thought were going for this film. And you touched on many of those. I didn't really think about the memory aspect, though you're certainly right that I think you can attribute that sensation watching this film and the suspense. Certainly, when you start getting certain bits doled out, you anticipate what may be coming next, and there is something thrilling in that. But I do think authentic is the right word. There is a rawness to these performances that I think covers up maybe any manipulation that you might be feeling with the storyline. And I can't stress enough how little interest I had in finishing this movie after those first 5 minutes. Not that there was anything wrong with them. The scenes were actually very well done. You talk about the medical scenes and how they're portrayed, but just hunkering down to watch a movie potentially about a dying kid or a suffering kid was something I wasn't really into. But you did recognize, or I recognized right away, that while this may be somewhat of a slog, when those performances, and there are moments, and I can't get this Michael Phillips word out of my head, it's the word he used with American Hustle, exuberance. There is exuberance. There is real joy.
Well, that's where the music comes in,
right?
Yeah,
the music comes in too, but there are a lot of moments around those musical scenes of pure joy, and yes, anguish too, but they're all authentic. They all feel like they're part of the human spectrum, and I do think the filmmakers seem genuinely interested in exploring some difficult topics and themes rather than sermonizing. And I think we can talk around that a little bit and get into that more, whether they're all the time successful. But fundamentally, I think that's what they're most interested in. They are really exploring, the same way the camera is exploring in these flashbacks. So I quickly got over the dying kid or the cancer part of this story. And the question, you answered it very well, but of course it was a trick question ultimately, because while you think about what the movie might have been if they had played it straight in terms of the chronology, if they made it linear, it's a fun game. It helps, hopefully, to provoke some discussion, but it is ultimately pointless because, of course, we'll never know how the other version of the movie would have actually played out. But especially because it's just not probably fair to separate the content and the form. It'd be like asking if Take Five, the great Dave Brubeck jazz tune, if it would still be a great jazz song if Brubeck didn't put it in 5/4. You could put the song in a traditional time signature, but everything about the way the instruments sound and play off each other and what they convey to the listener is inextricable from the time signature. So in thinking about that question, can it be a little bit of a cheat? And we've certainly seen it from Tarantino and filmmakers before him and a lot of filmmakers after him to use that nonlinear structure in a way. Can it feel like maybe they're reaching to try to add a sense of poignancy to something where it might otherwise be lacking? Or is it kind of a shortcut way of showing some visual creativity? Maybe, but I do think when it's done as elegantly as it is here, and it is done to enhance the experience of watching the movie and really enhance your understanding of these characters and their plight and the emotion, then it doesn't at all feel like a gimmick, and it's something that I really applaud about this film.
Yeah, it never felt gimmicky to me at all either, that's for sure. You also mentioned and touched on something else that this film is, which maybe came as a surprise. We've got this story of these parents struggling with coming to terms with their sick child. We've got the music, which we touched on. We can maybe talk about a little bit more, but there are numerous musical scenes here. It's also this science versus religion debate. And I like how you said it, that I think the filmmakers are interested in the debate rather than sermonizing from either side of it.
Yeah.
But what eventually develops is, in facing their daughter's sickness, these parents turn different ways. We get the sense that the father, played by Heldenberg, is sort of an angry atheist. We get little hints of that. And we get even slighter hints of Elisa's spirituality. She at least seems to embrace some sort of spirituality. So
it seems to burgeon after an experience.
Right, it does. That's a good way of putting it, because I was definitely, that's a fascinating topic to me, and I appreciated the angle the filmmakers seemed to be taking of it. It was exploring it through these characters, yet there was something both simultaneously too thin and too heavy about it,
right,
in the way they
pitted
the couple against each other. I wanted more of a sense of what her spirituality was rooted in. So to pump that up a little bit for me and let his atheism to become a little less shouty by the end. He becomes didactic in a way the movie is not.
Right.
But his character is in a way that kind of takes it out of the realm of this real world it's built up. But by the time he's arguing and shouting at George W. Bush on the TV over stem cell debates, we've been taken too far out of this interior domestic drama for this really fascinating debate to hold any sort of truth to it in terms of the story the film is telling.
Yeah, I fundamentally agree with everything you're saying. I think I disagree a little bit in the fact that I don't believe Eliza's transition or whatever spirituality she accepts is something that really needed to be explored anymore. Not for me. I thought really the scenes we got and the buildup up to the scenes where it starts to kind of take hold, I thought made perfect sense. It felt organic. I believed every second of it. But there's no doubt that I think what is going to turn a lot of people on this film, potentially, if they were enjoying it, there's some scenes later, about two-thirds of the way through, with the Heldenberg character that are potentially going to, I think, misguidedly have people thinking that this is a political film, that this is a film that's ultimately trying to espouse something about science versus religion. And the reason why is because you have that character who all of a sudden starts didactically shouting at you. It feels gratuitous. It feels like an attack. You do want him to shut up, certainly in the second scene where he just keeps going on and on. Obviously, that's a part of it. I mean, that's what the director's going for on some level.
I wanted him to have a better forum for his argument,
right?
I guess. I feel like the film is almost doing the character a disservice of his point of view by making him so strident to that point.
Yeah, I agree. But where I guess I ultimately forgave it a little bit is because even though in the moment I felt, okay, this is way too heavy-handed. Where is this going? Is this going to take the movie down a path I don't want it to go? It didn't ultimately go down that path. It really became more representative of his rage in general and him coming unhinged as a man, as a father,
sure,
as a husband. And that question about really where do we think the filmmakers are focusing their attention? What are they trying to explore here? For me, it really isn't about that debate about science versus religion or politics directly. It really is about exploring how these characters use those topics to deal with grief and then what that says about their state of mind. So that way it sort of bypasses the criticism for me that it's
no, that makes sense.
Too didactic.
That makes
because
sense.
It ultimately comes back to being about that exploration of tragedy and that exploration of a husband and wife and dealing with grief. And it's really reflective of their state of mind more than anything else.
And I think the final segment of the film circles back more towards that, which I think works much better. I did want to ask you, because this is a question that immediately popped into my mind when this element of the film came into play. Did you get Fruitvale Station vibes? And I'm talking specifically the dog scene vibes that turned you off to the whole film. The bird that flies into the glass on the veranda on their house's front porch. And the daughter who's come home because she's feeling a little bit better is coloring, I think, on the front porch. This bird hits the window and the daughter and her father have this long conversation about what happens after you die.
Yeah.
Not only that, but, you know, the dog, which I will say is a weakness of Fruitvale Station. We see this dog that's been hit by a car and is symbolic of the main character. The dog goes away. The whole idea of the dog never returns. This bird and the story about the bird persists for quite a while in the Broken Circle
breakdown. But
they return to it.
That's why it pays off, though, for me. If it was just that scene. For me, because then it plays into the larger story, and it plays into the wife and the mother's method of dealing with her
grief. I thought that was going to be your exit point.
No.
That was like carrying the dog in Fruitvale Station through the rest of the movie.
No, see, I just don't see it completely that way. I see it paying off the scene earlier. If I had to just watch that really pointed, really obvious meditation on what happens to us when we die between a father and daughter, that would have been rough. It was rough when I took it in that moment. At the same time, and this is hard to articulate, I think articulating what works about performances is always hard, but even watching that dialogue and feeling like it's way too on the nose, when the two performers in the scene are as genuinely heartbreaking as those two are for me, it didn't take me out of the film at
okay.
all. I was definitely aware of it. Definitely aware, but it didn't take me out of the film. And I do like the fact that it came back into play a little bit for me later. You talk about the music. Certainly, you know, I had no idea that anyone in Belgium was playing bluegrass music.
No kidding.
It makes sense.
But that there's
course,
all these people walking around with cowboy hats.
Sure.
And...
I mean, there's going to be that tradition. There are going to be countries everywhere that are going to tap into other countries' rich tradition. And the movie did make me think a little bit of Inside Llewyn Davis, because it's folk music. It's this timeless kind of music and this bluegrass music as well. But they're also both movies, Josh, that are, of course, nonlinear. And what this movie does that Llewyn Davis did so well, and we talked about it during our review, is sort of give you this sense of time being a continuum. Everything, because of that nonlinear structure and the way the camera moves and the way the movie's edited, it gives you the sense that the past and the present and the future are all blending together. There's one sequence, and I can't remember exactly where it is. I meant to jot it down, but we see Eliza move through time and space three times. There's two cuts that attach three scenes, and just the gracefulness of her movement that links those three scenes together and jumps you around, and yet you never feel lost because of it. It is truly seamless. So that editing, it was just so elegant that I felt like, again, I was kind of on this exploration. I was on this journey with these characters. But as I was saying about whether or not sometimes that technique of cutting between the past and the present can maybe push too hard to add some poignancy or feel like a little bit of a gimmick, there is something to say for a film that cuts away from a couple at their worst possible moment, the first time we've really seen them fight and feel like it's a dagger in their relationship, they're blaming each other and fighting with each other, jumping right from that to the moment they met.
Right.
And seeing
well,
the spark.
That's like the 500 Days of Summer tactic, right?
Right,
like,
it is.
It give you every sense of this relationship.
Blue Valentine's another movie I thought of watching this movie. But you see then what brought them together. And in the moment of their love perhaps dwindling and draining away, we go back to what originally launched it. But if it was handled with less sensitivity than it is here, I think it could be cynical. It could be almost a joke. That, you know, this is what you get for that spark. It's kind of like the filmmaker punishing you. Yep, you know what? It started out this way, but look how it ended. It's going to end in misery. That isn't the way it comes off here. It comes off as more of a reminder that those moments are just as real and just as valid and just as unforgettable as any of these other harder moments, these bleaker moments. And that's something, again, for this film that I give it a lot of credit, that some of those things I think could have come off in a cynical way and don't at all.
Well, and as far as the music goes and the connection to Inside Llewyn Davis, I think this film uses its songs and those musical sequences as effectively as Llewyn Davis
does,
really. I mean, I love the irony, for one thing, of Didier's repertoire. You know, here's the atheist, and his repertoire largely consists of Christian traditionals that they're pulling off just beautifully. And all of those music scenes, they really achingly recognize how song can be so many things at once. It's serving so many purposes for often two different characters in two different ways while they are singing. Sometimes they're finding romance in it, or they're seeking refuge. There's clearly catharsis in it as they're going through this with their daughter. And there's the religious aspect, and the movie just captures how a song can encompass that all at once.
I am a poor wayfaring stranger, while traveling through this world of woe, yet there's no sickness, toil, or danger in that bright world to which I go. I'm going there.
And I think it's interesting you point out his contradiction there. There's another contradiction in him, in that he is this grounded man of the earth type person. He doesn't believe in some of these highfalutin religious or spiritual ideas. But what is he doing when he's talking to his daughter about the blood infusion that she's getting? You know, she's getting new blood, and he says they're soldiers. Mm-hmm. You know, he's invoking these metaphors. He's trying to make her more comfortable. And they talk about Captain Chemo and what it's doing. Like, he's just as willing to make stuff up
to
as
use
anybody
story.
Else.
To use story. Right.
That's exactly right. To help cope with a situation. So that's a blatant contradiction in him that he doesn't see. And I love as well a more subtle contradiction, if you can even call it that, we get in the movie, where it is all about the way it's using time, as I was touching on, this sense of this continuum. It's all about this balance between things that seem permanent and impermanence. And what is more impermanent than life? The fact that it does end. Of course, we did go down this path with Llewyn Davis as well, but she's a tattoo artist, you know, and you think about, he says at one point, I care about this. I just don't know that I care enough to put it on my skin. But what do we learn? That she's someone who, she has these real, dynamic, life-changing encounters with men, and she tattoos their names on her body. But what happens when they're over, when those relationships are over? Guess what? She just covers them up.
Right.
Those tattoos aren't permanent. She can just go on, and that ties back in some ways to the music, even in the sense that what maybe attracts them to this music is the sense of permanence. The fact that there's always going to be this tradition of bluegrass music. That's never going to change. You can't shake that. There's going to be that heritage and maybe even a little bit of that ritual. So I just really liked how this movie gave us those juxtapositions of the permanence and impermanence and the things that really are ultimately unchanging throughout all time. Their love for their daughter, their love for this music, what they think at one point is their love for each other. There are certain things that no matter what is thrown at them are certainly not going to ever fade away. And it really is about these characters trying to hold on to something, to make something that is going to be around forever. It might be their love. It might be music, whatever it is that makes it meaningful. And when you're in a world where the things you care about the most can be ripped away from you with no purpose whatsoever, that's the battle. I think that's absolutely the battle that this movie explores in often beautiful ways. And I did throw out on Twitter, Josh, to our followers to give us some responses to this film if they had seen it. And as we talk about how great some of the songs are, one of our listeners, Jessica, she's at the Velvet Cafe. She said, a perfect film if you're in the mood for a cry. Excellent use of music. The band, like the choir in a Greek classic play.
Very much so.
It is, which I hadn't thought about it, but I think she's dead on.
And what I like about that is because they show up a couple of times, at least two come to mind right away, not on stage, not performing for a crowd.
Right.
The band shows up to come around the family and sing for them in a domestic situation. That's exactly what she's talking
about.
Yeah,
I think
like
she
that.
Did nail it. We also heard from at Ian T. McFarlane. He said, only thing more impressive than the bravery it takes to make a movie with so much heartbreak is that they pulled it off. And finally, I'm just going to say D-I-E, die, it looks like, underscore Krabbe, K-R-A-B-B-E. He says, the Broken Circle Breakdown has fantastic music, perfect chemistry between the two leads, great intimate moments, and few very sad scenes. We may try to do that from time to time here on the show, incorporate some of your feedback into our reviews. That is The Broken Circle Breakdown, again, an Oscar nominee from Belgium for Best Foreign Language Film. It's out in limited release. It will be available via iTunes and video on demand platforms on February 4th, and it's slated for a DVD release March 11th. If you see it and agree or disagree with our takes, you can email us, feedback@filmspotting.net. You can also leave us a voicemail, 312-264-0744, or find us on Twitter, @FilmSpotting and Facebook.com/FilmSpotting.
We'll be back with our final picks for the most anticipated performances of 2014. You realize, Adam, this means next week we're going to have to put together a real list.
Don't
say
it.
None of this easy stuff anymore. Oh. The stunning conclusion to this week's Film Spotting Top 5 is next. Stay with us.
Well, if I needed you, would you come to me? Would you come to me? My pain. If you needed me, I would come to you. I would swim the seas for to ease your pain. Well, in the night forlorn, all the morning's born, and the morning shines with the lights of love. We'll miss sunrise if you close your eyes, and that would break my heart in two.
Hey folks, just want to jump in again to get to our donations and share some thank yous and some great comments from our listeners. First, want to highlight our music there. We played a little bit of the version of If I Needed You from Townes Van Zandt that's in the movie The Broken Circle Breakdown, really beautifully featured there and really heartbreaking in that movie. So that explains that song, Josh. The first song you heard earlier in the show was from, I think it's fair to say, one of the most anticipated albums of 2014, the new single from Beck called Blue Moon. This is his first album in 6 years. It's called Morning Phase. It is set to come out on February 25th. So tie in with the anticipated performances of the year and also the movie we reviewed, Broken Circle Breakdown. Let's get to some of those comments and donations. We start with two new $5 a month donors, Peter Prehistoric Cool, I guess that's his film spotting nickname, in Seattle.
I just set up a monthly $5 donation, but as always, I seem to be unable to remember to put personal messages in PayPal payments. Anyway, congrats on another year of great film conversations. I also wanted to put in a plug for Philomena, one of the many really good films that sprouted up at the end of this year. Judi Dench is great, of course, but I thought Steve Coogan brought the perfect touch to his role as a journalist facing an unwanted midlife career shift. As everyone says, keep up the good work.
So Philomena covered last week on the show. This email obviously came in before we talked about that movie a little bit. I think we'd agree that it's a solid movie, and
yeah,
one of the reasons we thought so was because of Steve Coogan. Matt Reynolds in Astoria, New York, someone who was mentioned, Josh, on our last episode. I threw out the name as a donor, 100 out of 99 productions. Well, it turns out I went through the email bag, got a little background here for Matt. He says, "Hi, fellas. I just made an overdue donation. I have an ulterior motive, but I was actually waiting for the time to be ripe to donate, as opposed to donating only because the time was ripe. But first, let me say I'm a big fan of the show. I listen to it in regular podcast rotation on my walk to work, editing promos for an American television network, and I binge listen to a huge chunk of the back catalog on two road trips taken last year. I enjoy it so much that I kept listening after the debacle of Josh's Cedar Rapids recommendation.
Oh.
I have not seen Casa de Mi Padre.
I don't even think you should bother, Matt.
When not cutting promos.
You don't deserve it.
I spent the last few years finishing my first feature film, The Great Chicken Wing Hunt, a documentary comedy about buffalo wings and a quest undertaken by a band of spicy food buffs to find the world's best one. It's coming out in select theaters and on demand everywhere, including iTunes.
I would love you guys to see it, Matt continues, but understand that you probably won't, at least not right away, given the number of films you see and the fact that we're not getting a wide release. But I hope that Wing Hunt's reputation will grow, and someday someone will force you to watch it, and you'll think, man, I remember getting an email from that director, and wow, that was pretty good. And boy, I wished I would have watched it sooner. Oh, and he ends with this, Josh. Down with Cedar Rapids.
Love it.
Matt, no need to get the whole town angry at you.
See, you know, I would say that'd make a great film spotting t-shirt, except I gave Cedar Rapids a positive review.
Thank you.
I liked the movie. Now, it didn't come anywhere close to my top 10, much less topic.
Was it your
my top 10.
Topic movie of that year?
It was not.
Should have been, Adam.
But it was a movie I felt favorably about, so I can't say completely down with Cedar Rapids, but I do like your spirit, Matt. And I think he sent us a copy of The Great Chicken Wing Hunt. So, you know, after a great donation and a great email like that, it's one I do hope to catch up with. I don't know that we'll probably talk about it on the show, but I hope I get a chance to see it. I do love buffalo wings, so he's got me with the subject matter, huh? Right there. A new Buck a Show donation comes from Jeffrey Sanguillo. He's here in Chicago.
I've been a loyal film spotting listener for several years, and it's finally time to pay the dealer. I enjoy and anticipate your weekly discussions and use film spotting as a resource for adding movies to my Netflix queue. My donation is also a mini celebration of a recently accomplished personal cinema goal, seeing all of the movies on the IMDb Top 250 list, which took me several years considering the constant shuffling of the list. I believe that Adam has made a disparaging remark or two about the list before. While I certainly wouldn't call it my definitive list of the top 250 movies ever made, overall I've enjoyed the majority of the films on the list. Even those which I didn't think deserved to be on the list, it was often because they were an important piece of film or pop culture, which I was glad to be able to form my own opinion of. Now that I've completed the list, I'm going to rely more heavily on your show for ideas. That, and perhaps last year's Sight and Sound list.
So Jeffrey also notes he's here in Chicago and that he was hoping to make it out to our live show. I hope he did make it and had a good time. I don't think it was me, probably, who commented on the top 250, just because I don't really have a strong opinion about it. It might have been a previous co-host. I don't know about you, Josh. I know it is the much maligned IMDb top 250, and I get it. If you glance at it, you know, it's got The Dark Knight in the top 5 or 10. Which,
and isn't Shawshank
like movie,
always up there, like, around number
it's
one?
It's number one.
So
I think
it is
Shawshank
number, okay.
is still number one.
Is
so,
it?
Look, I love The Shawshank Redemption. Not every host on this show always has, but I'm a defender of it. I'm not going to put it as the number one film of all time. So
yeah.
It's hard to take that list too seriously, but I don't know that anybody's asking us to.
It's fair to say it's a very populist list, but I think it is a good reflection in the way that Jeff talks about, in what were cultural films that made huge impact for one reason or another you should be aware of. So that makes sense.
Well, we do have a few other great comments we want to get to, including this one from Kim Walker, who I feel bad because I read her donation. We read it on episode 472, so a few weeks ago, but didn't get to her comment. It's really good. She's from Memphis, and after the December 5th show, when you talked about the documentary on and played music by Memphis band Big Star and mentioned your admiration for Memphis director Craig Brewer all in the same show, I was so pleased. I decided it was time I paid the piper.
Your strategy paid off.
Yeah, I made a buck a week donation. I was really trying to just preach to the Memphis people out there. I made a buck a week donation, though not near enough to pay for all the enjoyment I get from film spotting. I hope it helps the bottom line. So thank you, Adam and Josh, for all the hours of entertainment and insight. Now, finally, I won't feel guilty when y'all read out this week's donors. P.S. If I could, I'd like to dedicate my donation to the greatest and last DVD rental store in Memphis, Black Lodge Video. The name is a Twin Peaks reference. Well, Kim, you didn't have to tell me that Black Lodge was a Twin Peaks reference. I mean, it's already now my favorite video store of all time. I don't even have to go there. Whenever y'all talk about a movie that sparks my interest, I can always depend on Black Lodge Video to have it. Craig Brewer is also a big fan, so much so he produced a short 6-minute video about it. You should check it out, and we will put that YouTube link in our show notes. PSS, it would be awesome if y'all read this on the show, because it would give me a reason to get them to listen to Film Spotting and maybe a couple of free rentals. Everyone there at Black Lodge, please give Kim a couple of free rentals.
Yeah, come on. Won't hurt you.
After that great email, thank you, Kim, for that. A few other donors we need to thank as well. William in Austin, Texas, and Amy in Oakland, who says it's been her favorite podcast for the past 7 years. We also heard from Sarah Arnoden in Asheville, North Carolina, and she's got a little message for us to share.
Happy 30th birthday to my husband, Edwin. I can't promise never to have an intense argument in a Greek hotel room, but I can say without a doubt that at the end of the day, I'll still want to put words to the song he writes on a ukulele.
How sweet.
Very sweet.
How sweet. Thank you, Sarah, and thank you, Edwin, longtime supporters of the show. Dave Moore in Atlanta says he's been a faithful Film Spotting listener for about 7 years, and although my schedule is too busy to stay caught up on the most recent episode, and therefore I rarely get to participate in Massacre Theater, I never miss a show. You two not only keep me updated on what I should see, but you keep me on my toes with things that are important to look for in great films. Adam, you even inspired me to start my own short-lived podcast called Film Royale about 3 years ago. Maybe one day I'll resurrect it in a different format. Matt, thanks for all the great work and sacrifice.
Another note here from Chris, who's in Barton, Cambridge, UK. This is long overdue. I've been listening since 2010, and now that I've finally found a good job, I can make this donation. Thanks for the hours and hours of incisive criticism and for introducing me to films such as Les Samurai and The Red Shoes, which have become firm favorites of mine. Keep up the great work, and I do feel kind of bad for asking this. Would you mind giving my blog a quick mention? It's a matter of lifeandfilm.blogspot.com, and I try to post reviews a couple of times a week, but sometimes that annoying thing called a job gets in the way.
So Chris earned that mention, not just with the donation, but the fact that, am I wrong here? That's got to be a clear reference to A Matter of Life and Death, the great film from the Archers. So Powell and Pressburger love, that's always going to get you far here on Film Spotting. That brings us to our final donor, and we do thank everyone here for indulging us in reading some of these comments, but really, we love to share these emails, and especially when you're donating to the show, we feel like you've earned it. Logan in Columbus, Georgia says, Adam, Josh, it's been over a year since I donated to the podcast, so this is far too small and long overdue. Last time I mentioned a great group of guys who'd recently started a site and podcast of their own, filmdispenser.com, and all they were doing locally to help build a film community. Since then, their reach and roster has expanded just a bit, and among others, now includes me. It was a shock being asked to join the team and has made for one of the most exciting years of my life. Writing a weekly DVD / Blu-ray column for the last 7 months, covering all things comic book as well as the occasional review, has been an unbelievable experience, one that may not have happened without you guys. So thank you, Adam and Josh, for continuing to expand my movie horizons and for playing a part in bringing some film lovers together. And a big thanks to the Film Dispenser crew, Spencer, Rafo, Scott, Justin, and Adam, for being the best movie-loving friends a guy could ever ask for. Here's to 2014, guys.
Yeah, Film Dispenser, I'm familiar with them from Twitter.
Me too.
Pretty active there. So yeah, good group.
Unfortunately, haven't been able to add anything new to my podcast rotation at this point, but after such a great email there from Logan and seeing some of their tweets and commentary online, I do hope to give Film Dispenser a try. Once again, thank you so much to every listener through this holiday season, and especially, you know, some of these, I meant to say this at the time, I'm pretty sure that Sarah's note there for Edwin and the one we featured at the top of the show for Dan Vaccaro from his wife Eve, those were supposed to be read like 3 or 4 weeks
ago.
That's
probably the case.
And, you know, they probably at this point feel kind of betrayed that they spent that money looking for a shout out around the holidays and they didn't get it. And, you know, that's just the way it goes sometimes, unfortunately, with our schedule and when we record. I do apologize for it, but can't thank everyone enough.
Well, ladies with me now, since since I showed her how to lay her lily hand in mine. Loop and Lil agree, she's a sight to see.
Hi, this is Matthew Vaughn. I am the director of Stardust, and you're listening to Film Spotting.
How's the ticker?
Still ticking.
Want to get in the war?
Monuments Men.
Signed by Roosevelt.
Oh, I see that.
And to put a team together and try to protect what's left and find what's missing.
Aren't you a little old for that?
Yes.
You're listening to Film Spotting with Adam and Josh. We return to our top five most anticipated performances of 2014 with that clip from the George Clooney-directed Monuments Men. That was Clooney with Matt Damon, giving you a pretty good plot description of the film. It's set during World War II. A small group of soldiers set out to save civilization's most important works of art. This is a movie that was scheduled to be released in 2013, but was pushed back to this year. So a year ago at this time, we were sitting here sharing our top five most anticipated performances of 2013, and this movie, featuring Bill Murray, Cate Blanchett, John Goodman, Jean Dujardin, in addition to Damon and Clooney, that ensemble snuck its way onto your list, Josh. Is this movie something you're still excited about?
I am.
Are you?
You've got to be a little bit leery of the release date being pushed back. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's just the reality. That rarely points to good things. I don't know if they simply felt that the awards field, end of year awards field, was too crowded for something like this. I mean, it gets so busy. I'm still talking to people who wanted to see films that they couldn't over the holiday week, just because so many big prestige studio products are coming out. Maybe that's what they were thinking. I don't know. I'm still excited.
This right here is another exhibit in my case against seeing trailers, because if I just knew the general storyline and I knew even the ensemble on paper who is in this film, this would be one of my most anticipated films of the year, hands down, this year or last year. But I saw the trailer not only recently, but last year as well. You know, it played before a movie, couldn't avert my eyes, though I tried. And there's just something about this trailer that comes off as, I don't know if patronizing is the right word, but it seems to be constantly asserting its own importance and why they're doing what they're doing. And I just see it. And every time I look at it, I think of The Men Who Stare at Goats, which is another movie that sounded great on paper and had a great ensemble and was pretty bad.
That's a fair comparison. There's something flat about the trailer, but we'll see.
We will see. Maybe it's a film we will discuss here on the show in the coming weeks. Not going to make your list again this year, certainly not going to make my list of the most anticipated performances of the year, but we get back to our countdown. Maybe we should actually start by just quickly recapping your number five and your number four picks, Josh.
Yeah, number five was Melissa McCarthy in Tammy, co-written by her along with her husband and directed by her husband, Ben Falcone. And then Ralph Fiennes in The Grand Budapest Hotel was my number four, film from Wes Anderson coming out in March. My number three, Monuments Men from last year, was my cheat for the list. This is going to be my cheat, number three. Two people here, it's only lovers left alive. And it's the story of two vampires who have been lovers for centuries. I can't pick between the two lead actors. It's Tilda Swinton and Tom Hiddleston.
How can you have lived for so long and still not get it? You've been pretty lucky in love, though, if I may say so.
I have what you need, not what I need.
Now, Tilda Swinton is a mesmerizing presence. Really, even when the movies she's in themselves may not be working. Something About Kevin, there's a movie called that. But let's
oh, how dare you.
Get back to that. Tom Hiddleston, my favorite thing about the Avengers, loved his villain Loki. And of course, he's done very different work that's been equally as good. Think about what a force he was in Terrence Davies, The Deep Blue Sea, opposite Rachel Weisz. So you put those together and it sounds really promising. Plus, this is one of those big directors that didn't make our list on the last show where we talked about all the important directors putting films out in 2014. Jim Jarmusch. So add that together, and this film could have easily been an honorable mention for one of my most anticipated. It does come out fairly shortly here, April 11.
Yeah, I don't know that I get that excited about any kind of vampire movie at this point, but Jarmusch's vampire movie, that's one I want to see.
That'll squeak past your anti-vampire.
Certainly. There you go. I do have a bias against vampires. I'm sorry. I'm a wolf guy, apparently. We learned that last week here on the show. My number three pick is the one that you certainly could have penciled in and been right about. Everyone listening who knows my fascination with the actor Michael Fassbender could have guessed I'd find a way to sneak him on this list, and I did. At number three, he stars in the movie Frank, which did make its debut just this month, a couple weeks ago, at the Sundance Film Festival. And the reason I'm picking it, even though, yes, of course, I would think about a Michael Fassbender role really for any most anticipated performances list, the reason why it's here is because in this movie, he plays the frontman of a punk band called The Freshies. And there are two challenges here, if you will. The first one being, it's a comedy, or at least that's how it's labeled. So this is another case of an actor doing something we don't normally see him mm-hmm. do. I haven't seen every Michael Fassbender film, but if you think about the ones that we've talked about on this show over the years, I mean, he's known for 12 Years a Slave and Shame and Hunger. Yeah. And
not the lightest stuff.
These are not laugh fests. So I want to see what he's going to do in this film. But on top of that, he's playing a role. I guess, I don't know if it's inspired at all by a band like Daft Punk, but he's playing a character who wears a paper mache head all the time. So you're not actually ever going to get to see Michael Fassbender's face.
You're not going to be able to see and gaze into those eyes. I'm surprised this is on your list.
I'm going to say they're hazel colored. I'm not sure, but I should know, certainly. But that's a challenge for an actor, obviously, when he doesn't have his normal repertoire of tools. He doesn't have his eyes. He doesn't have his entire face to use. So I think that it will be very interesting to see what Fassbender does with a role like that and with a funny role like that. Of course, I know he can do it all. He's Michael Fassbender, so I'm not worried, but I am excited to see it.
Well, really, think about it, though. The physicality is an important aspect of so many of his roles.
True.
So you take away the face and he's still, you know, in something like Shame particularly, or Hunger as well. I could see this being something he might be able to make work.
Yeah, I think he can, because come on, Josh, he can do no wrong. That movie is slated for a May release in the UK. I don't know if that will translate into a similar or a close release date in the US, but we will keep an eye on Frank, the actor, of course, Michael Fassbender, my number three most anticipated performance of the year. What's your number two?
My number two is a little bit obvious, but I'm still going to go with it. Joaquin Phoenix in Inherent Vice. We talk about directors finding stars who can serve as their muses, and I think it can work the other way around. I feel like Phoenix has found his muse in Paul Thomas Anderson. Phoenix's Freddie Quell in The Master, that's just going to be one of my most unforgettable movie characters, this primal beast trying to make the clothing of polite society fit. I just, that guy comes to mind so often, that character they created together. There's extra intrigue in this project, though. I know this is going to shock and appall you, Adam, but I've begun to read Inherent Vice, the Thomas Pynchon novel,
hey,
which I'm enjoying quite a bit.
You know what? It's only going to ruin your cinematic experience.
It
doesn't hurt me at all.
Fine. But here's the interesting thing. It's a fairly comedic novel so far. It's this story about a private eye and a former hippie, really, in 1970s LA. He's hazing his way through this sleazy investigation. And on the page so far, the guy's kind of like the dude and Philip Marlowe and a little Hunter S. Thompson, too. So trying to picture that, I know Anderson has certainly a comedic vein to him, but trying to picture that with Phoenix in the role as well, it just sounds really compelling to me, especially when you think about The Master, their last project together, which wasn't traditionally funny, let's put it that way. Inherent Vice right now doesn't have a release date. We're pretty much expecting it towards the end of the year.
Yeah, a great pick, though one probably just off my list simply because I expect greatness at this point from Joaquin Phoenix and Paul Thomas Anderson. Maybe not enough of a surprise there that really has me hooked, but certainly anticipating what he's going to do in that role. My number two is the actor Tahar Rahim. The film is The Cut, which is another one I don't have a release date for. It's in post-production right now. This is an actor, though, who came on my radar. I think it was really his first big role, his breakout role, if not his first film, and that was A Prophet, the movie directed by Jacques Audiard. And I compared him at the time. I interviewed actually him, Tahar Rahim, along with the director Jacques Audiard at Sundance when that film came out, and I compared him to a young De Niro. He reminds me of a young De Niro in Godfather 2 specifically, that Vito Corleone character, just some of the same mystery to him. He's also in the Asghar Farhadi film, The Past, which we have not caught up with yet, but really talented actor. You see that certainly in A Prophet. And what's going to be interesting about his performance in the cut, to kind of follow up where we left off with the physicality of Fassbender in Frank, is the director of this movie, Fatih Akin, describes the role as a bit like Charlie Chaplin, but at the same time, he's a typical Western character, like in a Sergio Leone movie. So imagine Chaplin and Leone, and the reason why he's making the Chaplin comparison is apparently his character doesn't have a single line in the film. So again, another one like Robert Redford and All Is Lost, where it's just going to be about his physical tools and what he's able to convey through his action. And it's not as if his character in A Prophet is another one who says a whole lot or reveals a whole lot. He's not necessarily a talker, so we know he's capable of it and just a really talented actor, and I want to see what he's going to do with a role like that. Fatih Akin as well. I don't know. Are you familiar with his work, Josh?
No,
I have
not.
To confess that I know these films. I'm familiar with Soul Kitchen coming out, but there's this trilogy, Love, Death, and the Devil. It started with Head On and The Edge of Heaven, and this seems to be the final piece in that trilogy, but I still haven't seen those movies, though I know over the years, Film Spotting listeners have talked about them quite a bit. So another reason why I'm intrigued, but mainly Tahar Rahim in the cut.
All right. My number one is going to a performance that's going to be in a huge film, possibly one of the year's biggest. It's Andy Serkis in Dawn of the Planet of the Apes. We talked about Scarlett Johansson's vocal performance in Her and how that chipped away at these concepts of such performances being second tier when you just hear the actor's voice. And, and some people have begun to rethink that in a way because she was so good there. Serkis has done this for motion capture performance already with his work as Gollum in Lord of the Rings and as Caesar in 2011's Rise of the Planet of the Apes, the predecessor to this film, which when I heard about it was a very dubious franchise reboot proposition to me. Ended up on my top 10 list for that year. Caesar is the uncommonly smart chimpanzee that's at this movie's center, and Serkis's performance was all about the movement, the way he conveys the character and this dawning intelligence in this chimpanzee just through his movement. The one scene that comes to mind from Rise of the Planet of the Apes is when he's still under his human caretaker's control and he's forced to wear a collar and he's taken for walks in the woods, and he just kind of tugs at the collar in a way that expresses this intelligent disdain for what's being done to him. The movie's littered with little elements like that that Serkis brings to it that just really expands it beyond a sci-fi spectacle. The technology, I have to think, has only improved a little bit in the few years since Rise of the Planet of the Apes, so that's going to lend a further believability. But for me, it's the way Serkis is going to use this to further expand our understanding of what movie acting is in this day and age. Dawn of the Planet of the Apes is a big summer film coming out July 11.
Yeah, Rise of the Planet of the Apes is a movie that took me completely by surprise. Just had no expectations whatsoever and did end up reviewing it here on the show and thought it was one of the better movies of that summer. My number one most anticipated performance is another that's a little bit of a cheat in that I'd like to go with this pairing. I certainly could narrow it down to just one of them if I had to, but I'm thinking of Nicolas Cage and Ty Sheridan together in David Gordon Green's next film. We saw a resurgence from him of sorts in Prince Avalanche, one of our Golden Brick nominees. We loved the Ty Sheridan character in that movie. And Cage, for me, you talk about actors, I think he was my number one actor most in need of a comeback, someone who you really want to see put aside some of the junk he's been doing and get back to some of those more serious performances from his earlier career, or even not so much serious, just good, right? I mean, he was always one of my favorite comedic actors to watch on screen. I'm hesitant a little bit because of the fact that if you read the plot description, this is a movie called Joe, slated for an April release, and it sounds very similar to Mud, the Jeff Nichols film, where we saw Ty Sheridan this year, this past year, so good in that movie as a younger kid, about 12, 13, and he befriends a con, a guy who clearly has some kind of criminal ongoings in his past or in his present. That's Matthew McConaughey, and they strike up this friendship. Well, this movie, Joe, is about Ty Sheridan as a 15-year-old who comes from a broken home, and he ends up meeting and forming a bond with this character who is an ex-con played by Cage, who, of course, is the title character, Joe. So I don't know how similar the films are going to be. Probably not really at all if you think about the sort of lyricism you get with a David Gordon Green film versus maybe a Jeff Nichols film. But Cage, for me, again, one of those actors, sort of like Michael Keaton, I have a nostalgic soft spot for.
Sure.
But in both cases, they've got the goods. They're legitimately talented actors. And Michael Keaton has fallen away and decided not to do so much acting. Cage takes every role under the sun.
He's fallen into everything.
Yeah, but they're just not very good, and he's become a caricature of himself. And at least from some of the early things I've heard about this, you pick up little nuggets here and there. The trailer is actually out online for Joe just a few days ago, I think, and I did not watch it before coming in for this top five. But from what I've heard, it is a more understated, less shouty, less obnoxious Nicolas Cage. So you combine Sheridan and Cage together in David Gordon Green's movie, another one that's going to be a serious film from David Gordon Green, and I can't wait to see it.
What are you thinking, Joe?
Nothing. There's nothing I can do, and I hate it. I don't know who I am, but I know what keeps me alive is restraint. Keeps me out of jail. Keeps me from hurting people. And I watched that boy. He's a child. Folks left behind. He could go good. He could go bad.
Yeah, good pick. Honorable mention for me. Definitely consider that. Have a couple other honorable mentions. We talked about one, Miles Teller in the Sundance Discovery Whiplash. Michael Shannon in that Jeff Nichols film coming out this year, Midnight Special, reteaming with the director with a lead role like he had for Take Shelter, about the father of a son who has special powers. Bill Murray is going to have an interesting part this year in St. Vincent de Van Nuys. He's this misanthropic neighbor of a boy whose parents just divorced, shades of his Herman Bloom in Rushmore, perhaps there. And then Carey Mulligan is going to be in a Thomas Hardy adaptation, Far From the Madding Crowd.
Mm-hmm.
We both talked about how maybe one of the very few weaknesses of Inside Llewyn Davis was that she didn't get quite enough to do there. Hopefully this will give her that.
Honorable mentions for me start with three actresses. Alicia Vikander, I mentioned her as one of the stars of Ex Machina. That was my number five most anticipated movie of the year. She was a real standout for me in Anna Karenina last year. Mia Wasikowska in the movie The Double. And your favorite actress of all time, Josh, Quvenzhané Wallace.
She's really my favorite actress of all time.
Well, it just
I didn't know she was elevated to that status.
In Annie.
Yeah.
And, you know, am I looking for another Annie in my life? No, I am not.
Can never have enough Annies, Adam.
But Quvenzhané Wallace, very good actress based just on what we saw in Beasts of the Southern Wild. And this couldn't be more of a departure.
No,
that's
I can't even imagine her in something like this. So it'll be interesting.
It will be interesting. Especially because, too, it's being directed by Will Gluck, the guy who made Easy A, movie starring Emma Stone, which I really like. This could be a bit of a disaster, but at the same time, with him at the helm and with Wallace in it, I'm curious. And one other quick honorable mention for me, really strong contender for my top five, James Franco in Everything Will Be Fine. This is the film that did come up in our Part 1 2014 preview because it's the latest from Wim Wenders, and it's sort of an intimate drama, but Wenders is going that 3D route. So that's one reason I'm curious about it. But Franco's character in particular, he's a guy I certainly have talked about a lot in Spring Breakers and a few other roles. I love when he disappears into characters. This seems like he's playing more of a James Franco type character, a writer. And he's someone who's naturally very curious and becomes obsessed, which I think sort of defines the James Franco persona we've come to identify with. And he's an author who has a role in a serious accident that I think a child dies, and he spends the next 12 years or so investigating the fallout of that and his role in that and beating himself up over it. So that's one, certainly with Wenders and Franco together, I really want to see. Don't have a release date on that one yet either, but if you do want to find a list of all the films we mentioned here in part one or two of our 2014 preview, you can find them at filmspotting.net. Just click on the top five link, and those are our top five most anticipated performances of the year. Send your picks or any other comments about the show to feedback@filmspotting.net.
You can also leave us a voicemail, 312-264-0744, or find us on Twitter at filmspotting and at facebook.com/filmspotting.
Run through these limited releases here, opening in Chicago, Two Autumns, Three Winters. The Academy Award-nominated short films are also playing at Middleton. This is a movie about a pair at Middleton, stars Andy Garcia and Vera Farmiga. They apparently go on their college tour with their children and fall in love. Like Father, Like Son also opening. This is the latest from the Japanese director Hirokazu Koreeda. He made I Wish, about a father who learns that his real son was switched at birth. Yes, if this was the plot of an American film, it would be a comedy. It would star Vince Vaughn, but this is not a comedy.
This isn't Delivery Man 2.
No.
Okay.
No. Out in wide release, That Awkward Moment with our guy, Miles Teller, along with Michael B. Jordan from Fruitvale Station and Zac Efron. They're about guys in their 20s who, I guess they just don't get the ladies, Josh.
Oh, you're kidding me.
We could share some advice with them, I'm sure. Labor Day from Jason Reitman, the director of Juno and Up in the Air, about a depressed single mom and her son who get involved with an escaped convict. That convict, I'm guessing, is Josh Brolin and not Kate Winslet. She's playing the mother.
My guess is it'd be more fun if it was the other way around.
Yeah, it might be. This is one I wanted to review here on the show, but
you
were really against it. So next week, Michael Phillips will return from his standout performance at our live show a few weeks ago. We're going to discuss one of the movies he singled out during that rap party, The Great Beauty. Also talk about our top five movies about fame. The Italians, they've never made any great movies about fame before. I don't know how we'll ever come up with the top five. We also will spend a few minutes on the new documentary from Steve James about Roger Ebert, Life Itself.
Film Spotting is produced by Golden Joe Dassault and Sam Van Halgren. Without Sam and Golden Joe, this show wouldn't go. Thanks to associate producer Candace Griffiths, and special thanks to everyone at Chicago Public Media. Chicago Public Media creates award-winning content about the issues that affect our community, our nation, and our world. More information is available at chicagopublicmedia.org. Our featured music comes from Beck. It's from his forthcoming album, Morning Phase. You can find more information at Beck.com. We also heard Townes Van Zandt's If I Needed You. That's from the Broken Circle Breakdown soundtrack. And more information is at TownesVanZandt.com. For Film Spotting, I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.